Welcome to The Art of Authenticity, a weekly podcast that explores what it really means to be authentic and build a life that's truly you, featuring in-depth interviews with successful business leaders, entrepreneurs, authors, and thinkers. By sharing their stories, daily practices, and habits, they will help you find a life that is successful and authentic. I'm your host, Laura Coe, author, entrepreneur, and coach. Welcome to the show. Welcome to this episode. Ron Lieber has been the Your Money columnist for the New York Times since 2008. He has come out with his new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, published in February 2015, and it was an instant New York Times and Wall Street Journal bestseller. I have the pleasure of knowing Ron personally, and I'm so excited to share this episode. Most of us think about money discussions with our kids as this taboo subject. Yet as a parent, I really worry about the rising tuition costs in our country. Ron writes this very timely book to help parents start the much-needed conversations with our children about money. Not only that, but he dives into the bigger question, how much is enough? Enjoy the show. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and write a review. Thanks for listening. Hi, Ron. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here. I'm so excited to have you. Ron Lieber, the author of The Opposite of Spoiled, is joining us to talk about his book and hopefully many, many other things. So thank you very much for coming. So Ron, I have to ask, before we jump in, I read your dedication and you put in there that this was for Jodi and Talia, who spoil me. And obviously I get the tongue in cheek, but like, I have to ask, was that more than just tongue in cheek on the idea of spoiling, or what did you have in mind when you wrote that?
Well, they spoil me with love and good feelings. I think it much depends on how you view that term. And, you know, I put that word on the cover of the book for a reason, because it evokes all sorts of responses. And, you know, I can't always tell how people are going to feel about it. I knew I needed to define it in the course of doing my reporting. So, you know, to me, the word spoil in the context of parenting is, you know, a situation where a kid has no rules at all, or if there are any rules, they're not enforced, or, you know, you're in a situation where the child never really has to do very much for themselves, where every time they fall over, the parent picks them back up again, and, you know, the path is completely smoothed over. The parent is doing the negotiating, with the teachers, and, you know, the kid is literally not allowed to fail. The only time it has anything to do with money is kind of at the end, where, you know, you talk about the kinds of kids who have lots of stuff or get to do lots of things and they don't show much appreciation for it. You know, that too is spoiling. But, you know, in other contexts, in a familial context, I think, you know, spoiling someone with love and devotion, I'm not sure there's a downside to that.
Exactly right. You can never have too much of that. I love that. That's a great, great way of thinking about it. And what inspired you around this topic to write about this word? I love this point you make that, right, there's such a negative connotation around it, especially when it comes to money. And it's particularly right now with a time we have so much abundance. What inspired you to write about this specific topic?
Well, it started with a practical problem that I was encountering repeatedly in my day job at the New York Times, where I write the Your Money column, the personal finance column. And, you know, while nobody was really paying much attention, we all of a sudden hit a point in America where if you want to go to your flagship state university, there's a pretty good chance it's going to cost you $100,000 unless you get any financial aid. And if you want to go to a private college or university without aid, you know, you're looking at $250,000 in many instances now. And what was happening was that a lot of super impressionable teenagers, still children, I think we would all agree, were making really bad decisions, not only about where to go and how much to spend, but how much to borrow. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a lot about the student loan problems and where they had come from. And I knew that there had been some failure in parenting here, right? You know, which is not to take blame away from, you know, the system or the institutions that, you know, convince or encourage students and families to take on debt. But it was clear to me that there were not a lot of financial conversations going on leading up to this six-figure conversation that all of a sudden these impressionable teenagers were having. And I thought, okay, well, this is an area where I might be able to do some good. And I started to look at all of the things that had been written over the years about financial literacy. And that term was just a really big turnoff to me, and I think a lot of other people. It feels very kind of dutiful and nuts and bolts. But as I began to think about it and consider the questions that my own now older daughter was asking me at the time, I realized that there was a connection between her really big searching questions about money and the values that my wife and I stood for. Because, you know, every time you spend or save, or certainly when you give money away, it says something about who you are, what your priorities are. And those are values discussions. Those are not just money discussions.
Yeah.
So what I realized was that there was actually a direct connection between talking to kids about money, teaching them financial lessons, giving them opportunities to practice and kind of ride along as their parents made financial decisions. There was a connection between all of that and teaching kids values. And the values part of this was something that I thought almost everyone would be interested in, even for people who find financial literacy to be a turnoff. So that was kind of the beginning of how it started. And it was only when parents started to ask me to speak in front of the groups that I began to kind of coalesce my ideas around this word spoiled and what it meant.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important that the college tuitions have gone up so much, and to ask an 18-year-old to put themselves in debt, like you say, it without any conversations, without any dialogues, without any practice, right? It really, I think you use the word lunacy in your book, but it is, right? To put them in such a big place with so little experience. It's something that seems so obvious now that you say it, right? But it isn't something I think we thought about.
I mean, the system literally makes no sense, right? And, you know, we are the only civilized nation that does anything like this. We should really be ashamed of ourselves. You know, maybe someday it will be different, or it will be fixed, or, you know, we'll be blown to smithereens by some or another innovator. But I think for, you know, many more years, we're going to be facing the same kinds of decisions that families are facing today. And for better or for worse, we've got to get our kids ready for
it. Yeah, I am hoping something major happens as well. But I agree, it doesn't seem anytime soon. Well, when you were younger, did your parents engage you in money? Was this something that you really thought about and came up with on your own? Or did you have good experiences as a kid with your parents practicing these ideas?
Yeah, well, you know, every family has their own story. Mine is not unique, but, you know, I don't know. I at least consider it singular. I mean, I had a dad who was a certified public accountant, right? So, you know, he was a numbers guy by trade. So, you know, I knew that numbers were important, that they were powerful, that you could make a living, you know, sort of counting and manipulating and helping people sort things out and put them in plain English. So, you know, you sort of started from that baseline. Then my parents got divorced, which is a big financial event in addition to being a big emotional event. You take one household and you turn it into two. That's an expensive proposition, and it generally means changes for families unless they are very affluent, which we were not. And right after the separation happened, one of my parents lost their jobs, and our family's financial situation, our household income, or what the household income would have been if the household was still intact, did not really return to where it had once been until 8, 10, 12 years after the separation. So there was a long period of a, you know, pretty significant change in circumstances. Now, you know, we went from being upper middle class to middle class. We went from having maybe a little bit more than average in our private school community in Chicago to having less than average. But we were by no means destitute. We didn't have to move out of our primary home. But still, it was a pretty severe change in perspective. I went from being, you know, a full payer to being one of the scholarship kids. So, you know, and then we had to navigate the financial aid system for college. And so, you know, I think all of those things were formative for me and, you know, caused me to be somebody who was conscious of what people have and how they display what they have and what you can judge or not judge about somebody on the basis of what they have or how they behave. And I became a little bit of a student of that. So, you know, I guess in retrospect, it's not surprising that I grew up to, you know, play Dr. Money on the pages of the New York Times for a living. But nobody would have ever predicted that when I was 16. I mean, I wasn't and I'm still not all that good at math, for instance.
That's funny. And I mean, I think this whole idea that you're talking about, though, that these ideas of money and that a lot of it comes with thinking about yourself first, because how do you teach your children if you haven't really questioned these values and ideas and what matters and your priorities for yourself? So it sounds like you went through that struggle within yourself first and then brought it to your family?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, everyone in my family was struggling with it in their own way. You know, my mother was very straightforward about the situation. My dad did not really want to talk about the financial situation much at all. You know, I was trying to puzzle it out up to and including going into their filing cabinets and getting the tax returns to try and see what the hell was going on. You know, those numbers didn't mean a whole lot to a teenager, but, you know, I was sort of doing my best to sort things out. So, you know, everybody struggles with it in a different way. But, you know, when I talk to teenagers about why the grownups in their lives often shut them out when it comes to financial conversations, the way that I try and frame it is that most people are not willing to be honest and forthright and authentic about their sense of shame around money. And people feel it in all sorts of ways up and down the socioeconomic spectrum. If you have more money than average, maybe you feel shame because you didn't earn it, right? Maybe you inherited it, or you know, you got lucky working for a company that went public and you know, you made a bunch of money that way, but you don't think you really deserve it. Maybe you have shame because you earned the money in a way that other people think is sort of gross or inappropriate, even if it's legal. Or maybe you earned it in a way that's not legal and nobody knows that. Nobody knows that you broke the law to earn that money. I think there's a lot more people out there like that, you may think. You know, you've got this sort of shameful secret. Or maybe you have less than average in America or in your neighborhood or in your private or public school community, wherever you are in your circle of friends. And you feel like that happened because you made the wrong choices about what to do for a living or because you didn't save enough or you spent in a way that was inappropriate. And then I think people of all levels of income and assets feel shame about poor decision-making or the examples they may be inadvertently setting for their children around, you know, what they save and their habits around money and the things that they do that they know that their kids are picking up by osmosis, right? So I think we all have shame and most of us aren't willing to talk about it out loud. And that's a, you know, part of the problem that leads to the, you know, cone of silence around money that I spend a lot of my daytimes trying to shatter.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think shame, Brené Brown tells us, secrecy and silence, right, are the two pieces of the puzzle that shame needs to stay alive. And certainly we all are very quiet about our financial issues and harbor that responsibility and feel like we're the only ones going through it. So it's wonderful to bring this message out. And if there was one message that you would hope people would take away from the book, is there a singular point that if nothing else, they walked away and brought into their homes?
Sure. I think I would ask people to remember that when their kids ask them really pointed, searching questions about money, that the proper response is to honor their curiosity and recognize it for what it is, because our kids' job, really their only job, is to figure out how the world works, right? And there's all sorts of ways we and their teachers and their, you know, religious leaders and other family members and other people they encounter, their coaches, can help them do that, right? But that's the point of the exercise, right? So if we're trying to help them figure out how the world works, of course we're going to need to have these money conversations, because money is an incredibly powerful force in the world, whether we like it or not. So it's only natural that kids are going to be curious about it and are going to ask a lot of questions. If we shut them down, their conclusion is going to be that, you know, not only is that avenue of inquiry permanently closed off, but there may be other important avenues of inquiry, things around sex or drugs or mental or physical health that they want to ask about, that they'll decide, well, my parents or parents is probably not going to, or not probably not going to want to talk about that either, right? So, you know, I don't think we want to shut it down. And if we can just remind ourselves every time that they ask these questions that, you know, every money conversation and, you know, many of the transactions in our daily or monthly financial lives are an opportunity to narrate, to tell a story, to connect kids to values and virtues like modesty and patience and thrift and generosity, gratitude, perspective, perseverance, that we want to, you know, imprint in their silly little heads. And, you know, each and every one of those values and virtues, the things that really add up to the opposite of spoiled, which is what I think we're all trying to accomplish in our parenting, every one of those things, you can get there through a financial conversation. So I think we need to consider these questions as the opportunity that they are to have a conversation about values.
I love that, because money gets demonized. And the truth is that money is the currency with which we make transactions, and the meaning we place on it, that's us. That's us bringing that to the table. And those are the conversations that we're avoiding. But it's not the money itself that is necessarily an issue. Ron, you know, looking from the outside, you have what most people consider a really successful life. You're working at the New York Times. You've got a New York Times bestselling book. You have a new child and a great family. This podcast is ultimately about what it means to have success and also have an authentic life. If you don't mind, I'd love to ask you a couple of questions about the subject.
Sure.
So we've talked a little bit about shame and all these values and these core things. This word authentic is thrown around so often, passion. What does it mean for you to have an authentic life?
Well, the big cosmic question that I'm constantly asking, sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously, certainly of my readers and in my public talks, but also of myself. It's a question that certainly applies to money, but it really applies to almost every facet of life. And that question is this: how much is enough? Mm. How much money is enough? How much apartment is enough? How much kitchen renovation is enough? How much vacation is enough?
Yeah.
How much health or weight loss is enough? How much time with my children and with my spouse and with my parents, including one parent who is sick right now and will probably die in a couple of years? How much of that is enough? And to me, the search for authenticity is a search for the answer to that big question and all of the little sub questions that come along with it. The search for answers that I can live with.
Because everybody has their own experience with that. Yeah. Mine isn't the same as yours.
Right. You know, we each have our own story there, right? I mean, look, money is what I do for a living. And, you know, the question of how much money is enough is one that, you know, people often struggle with their whole lives, right?
Yes.
You know, how much more do you really want or need to strive for? And are you striving for it because you really need, you know, additional funds? Or is it because you want additional things or want to do additional things? And if so, why do you feel that way? And is it because of the situation that you've chosen to insert yourself in you know, your hyper-competitive, suburb that you live in, or the rapidly gentrifying urban neighborhood, or the private school, or the competitive public school? Or have you, or could you, you know, opt out of all of that and, you know, be someplace else where you might not feel the same things, where the people around you have an entirely different definition of enough. And would that feel good? Or would that feel like you had, you know, sort of taken yourself out of the race that you thought you could win, right? I mean, these are the things that we struggle with our whole adult lives.
Was this something, it sounds like you've given this a lot of thought, and obviously you've talked about it as the subtext of your book. Have you been on the path of authenticity for most of your life? Was it something you've struggled with and you had a big turning point? Some people say, you know, I know I've always sort of trusted my instincts and my gut, and I've navigated it throughout my life. It's not always perfect, but in a lot of ways, I've never really had a completely inauthentic life. Other people have what feels like a completely inauthentic life and some kind of crash where they make a left turn. What was your story?
You know, I haven't had all that many radical shifts during my career. All I've ever done is work as a journalist, and I've been a quote unquote business journalist for my whole career. But, you know, a big part of what I've been trying to do is sort of stretch the definition of business journalism, and in particular, personal finance journalism, over the last 10 or 12 years that I've been doing that full time, sort of stretch it to its kind of lunatic fringe. So, you know, I think about the markers along that path, right? Because again, right, my freshman economics professor, you know, thinks it's hysterical that I'm a personal finance columnist, given how much I struggled in his class. But part of getting my head straight around, you know, sort of figuring out what I was good at and wanted to spend my life doing, in other words, kind of finding my most authentic professional self, was being comfortable with the fact that I often struggle with the mechanics and the science and the mathematics behind some of the topics that I write about. And that is, in fact, a good thing, because most of my readers, most of the people I'm trying to help, are exactly the same way. They find this stuff baffling and intimidating and overwhelming. And I'm not unlike them. And so, you know, if I can get my thick skull wrapped around it, there's a pretty good chance that I can translate it into plain English for readers. And so when people say to me, "Ron, when I read your writing, it sounds like you talking," that's sort of the highest compliment that someone can pay me. So first I had to figure out that, you know what, it's okay that you're not so good at the science of some of the things that you write about, that that might actually be an asset. I think the second thing that happened that was transformative was when I was applying for a job at the Wall Street Journal, and the editors there sort of saw something in me that I hadn't seen in myself, which was that, you know, when they asked me about my own sort of experience as a consumer before they hired me to help start their consumer news section, you know, I had all sorts of stories to tell them about exploiting the frequent flyer mile system and, you know, all of the fancy footwork that my mom and I did to qualify for more financial aid in college. And they said, "Ron, your beat at the Wall Street Journal, your area of coverage, is going to be the same beat that your beat in life has been all along to this point. Your beat is beating the system." And as soon as they explained it to me, you know, all of these doors and windows kind of flew open in my head. And, you know, pretty soon I was the guy at the Wall Street Journal writing about how to return your wedding gifts for cash.
Right. Because, I mean, the truth is there's a subset of people, my brother being one of them, that actually really enjoy finance at its deepest core level of, you know, what the markets are doing. And, I, you know, within 4 minutes I'm sleeping. But like you said, there's the rest of this stuff that's day-to-day financial life, and it's very intimidating and overwhelming. I mean, just the type of mortgage to apply for and how much and what the terms mean. I mean, and most of us are embarrassed to admit we don't know.
Yep, but we should not be embarrassed, because there's just an ever-growing number of choices, which is theoretically a good thing, but also all sorts of bad actors trying to convince us to make the wrong ones. And so no one should be embarrassed, including very smart people, that they don't understand what's going on here, because it's just too much to absorb. I mean, you could literally spend 40 hours a week kind of micromanaging and fine-tuning your personal financial life. There's kind of that much stuff to kind of manage and look into. So no one should feel ashamed that they can't figure it out. You know, and then there was this. There was one more thing that I think made a big difference for me, and it has definitely changed the way I approach my work. It was meeting, and I don't want to say discover, even though I was the first person to bring him to a much wider audience. But, you know, he approached me because he thought we had a lot in common. It was a financial planner in Utah named Carl Richards, who had a habit of, you know, when his clients did not understand something that he thought was kind of fundamental, he would sort of challenge himself to take out a piece of, you know, sort of white cardboard, you know, kind of thin paper stock and a Sharpie, and to see if he could draw it for them. He's since then, you know, has become a regular contributor to the New York Times. And if you Google Carl Richards, New York Times, you'll see a gallery of hundreds of sketches and essays that he's now written for us. It's just amazing stuff. And I can't recommend his books highly enough for people who feel intimidated by personal finance. But the thing that he drew for me that is, you know, easily my most favorite sketch, it was just an equation. And it said, money equals feelings. And I just love it for so many reasons, right? Because a big part of his, you know, sort of shtick is that our behavior, our bad behavior in particular, has a huge impact on our financial lives, and in particular our investments, because we tend to, you know, buy more stocks when stocks are doing well and sell when stocks are doing poorly. And that's actually the worst thing you can do for your portfolio.
Right.
So, you know, feelings are a big part of that. But, you know, for me and my work with parents and families and really almost every column I write for the New York Times, there's some element of emotion, of feelings. And, you know, we see the word feelings, we think of that as a kid's word, right? You know, hurt feelings and soothed feelings. But, you know, grownups don't always do such a great job of acknowledging their own feelings in all of their kind of raw splendor and considering just exactly how those feelings are changing the way they think about money, the way they think about parenting, the way they think about, you know, all sorts of things. And so, you know, I keep the money equals feelings equation posted at, you know, every workstation I have in my life, just to remind myself of what this is really about.
Obviously, right? My book, Emotional Obesity, this is a passion point of mine. And so many people approach me with financial issues or relationship issues or weight or, you know, they present the thing, but behind those things are the feelings that we're not dealing with. And it's interesting that in your work, you came across this idea of shame, because at the root of it is an issue with people feeling they're alone in their feelings of, you know, not being good enough, not providing enough. Like, you know, the list is pretty much endless. And so I love that simple picture. And I think if we could shift culture at all to be more comfortable with our feelings, right? They're not something to just stuff down and to move past. I think we'd all realize we're all having very similar experiences.
No doubt.
Yeah. And now that you're in a place where you have the success and authenticity, do you have daily practices? What do you do to keep it going? Do you meditate? Do you go for walks? How do you not make an inauthentic decision?
It's a tough question to answer right now, because my routine, such as it is or as it was, has totally been thrown into chaos by the arrival of a teeny tiny person. So it's going to be interesting to see once things normalize, or if they normalize, you know, how things will have changed. I mean, I wish I could say that I did anything with great regularity that was helpful. But there are a couple things that have changed in the last couple of years, and whether it's coincidence or whether it has something to do with, you know, what I've been able to accomplish with this book, I don't know. I'll let you decide. But, you know, there were a couple things that changed. First of all, I started running again for the first time. I've had a series of back problems over the years. And, you know, I convinced myself over the last 20 years that running or basketball or anything that involved pounding was just out of the question, because I would hurt myself. But when I was getting started with the reporting for The Opposite of Spoiled, one day I opened up Facebook and there were a whole bunch of my friends and neighbors, you know, signing up that day for the Brooklyn Half Marathon before all of the slots were filled. And I looked at that, you know, and I knew I was going to need some distraction from sort of the hardcore work of reporting. And I'd never run more than 3 miles at once in my life, even when I was training for basketball. I just hated it. I thought, you know what? I can probably do that. And I just, without thinking much about it, I hit the button and I registered. And I managed to do it. And then I did it again the next year, a little bit faster. And now all of a sudden I'm a runner, sort of. I've fallen off the wagon, you know, the last couple of months as the baby's been around. But that was something, you know, doing trying a physical activity that I wasn't sure that I could accomplish, but that was clearly within my reach. And then doing it, it did a lot for my confidence and for my psyche. So that was important. And then there was one other important thing that changed. In the course of my research, I did a lot. I looked at all of the good kind of social psychology and psychology of happiness research that's been done on gratitude and gratitude rituals, you know, in the course of trying to help parents, particularly parents of some means, trying to, you know, get their kids to have some perspective on what it is they have and how good they may have it. And it was clear to me that having a regular gratitude ritual was super important and could, in fact, contribute to, you know, the improvement of one's happiness in a real way, even if you can't measure or quantify it. So I started my own gratitude ritual that involves the F train in New York City.
What is that?
Well, it's just, you know, every time it comes, and sooner or later it eventually comes on most days, you know, once I see the headlights in the tunnel coming towards me, I stop for a second and I put my head down and just try and think about one or two things from the last 24 hours that were really awesome, right? And it could be a person, it could be a meal, it could be a tree, you know, it could be a song that I heard for the first time or a song that I heard for the 7,000th time, but that I hadn't heard in 20 years.
Yes.
Whatever it is, something that, you know, lifted my mood, elevated my spirits, that gives me an opportunity to focus on the things that I already have or have access to that are great. And I think about that for a few seconds before the train pulls in. And, you know, maybe it was a coincidence or maybe it wasn't, but I was definitely a happier person by the time I was done with a book and had adopted that gratitude ritual than I was before.
Positive psychologists agree with you. They say if you scan your life for different things, they say 2 to 3, so you were right in there, that you'll feel more gratitude. Because for us to say, I'm grateful, we all do the gratitude thing. We say, I'm grateful for my house, I'm grateful for my family. It's the same few things. But in fact, that doesn't make any meaningful impact. But if you change it up the way you are, where you do the last 24 hours, which I love. I haven't heard that one before. But if you pick 3 unique things, it does improve your mood. So that's awesome.
Yeah. And I think you want to go highly specific, right? Like, you know, I haven't been home in 36 hours. So if I were to do it out loud right now, I would say thank you for the people from my high school and my college who almost always show up wherever I am when I'm out giving a speech. There were a bunch of them last night and it made me feel really loved and supported. I feel grateful for hush puppies. I had some of the best hush puppies I've ever eaten at lunch today. There are not enough of those in the world, particularly north of the Mason-Dixon line. So I'm glad for that. And I'm glad that the emergency exit row on the airplane has extra leg room and that most of the time I managed to get a seat there.
Well, I'm going to say I am grateful for having you on the show and for your wonderful discussion on these absolutely critical points that the world needs to hear more of, with the impending financial crisis with the colleges and raising children in today's era. It's just an incredible topic to be covering. And so I am very grateful for you to take the time to be on our podcast today to talk about it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Ron, so much. It was great chatting with you.
Okay. Look forward to doing it again soon.
Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope you found some value in this interview. If so, it would mean the world to me if you hit subscribe, completed an iTunes review, or shared it with a friend. Every little bit counts. I'm super grateful for every single one of you, and I couldn't be more excited to be here. Signing off, I'm Laura Koh, and I'll see you guys next week.